So our goal as the treaty team is through this whole process is to try bring a treaty to membership that ticks all the boxes. Does it include the land base? Does it include economic opportunities? Does it return jurisdiction and decision-making in our territory? Not just for now, but for future generations as well.
You're listening to the Treaty Talk Podcast. Today's topic is a path to reconciliation with the most updated information as of October 2021. Stay informed and updated with these podcasts as we continue to push the government into negotiating a treaty that is optimal for our community to sign off on.
Everybody, it's great to be back to talk on another podcast. Today we have Wiwakai Elder Mark Lewis, and we also have Wiwakai member Sydney Moon with us, Bram Rogachevsky, who is our chief negotiator for the Liquito Treaty Society. Today we want to talk about how we're using all the tools of reconciliation in our negotiations. In this way, we will continue to push the government so that we can see positive results from this treaty and live in a world where all our title and rights have real meaning. So today we want to introduce Mark.
Well, Mark Lewis, band member, and I also sit on the Elders Council.
All right, thanks for that, Mark. I'd like to introduce Bram, our chief negotiator.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening to our third podcast. My name is Bram Rogachevsky, and I have the honor and the responsibility of representing Wiwakai's interests in treaty negotiations as your chief negotiator. Josh, thanks for pulling together this podcast on this, I think, important topic and having a chance to just have a chat. And Mark and Sydney, thanks a lot for joining us as well.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for that, Bram. I want to turn you over to Sydney.
Thank you. Yeah, so I grew up in Cape Mudge. I'm a band member. Right now I live in Tofino. I work as a finance manager for another First Nation, but I've been involved with the Treaty Society since I was in high school, and I've been attending the Treaty Society meetings and AGMs basically since that same point.
All right, thanks for that, Sydney. Yeah, so today's topic is the Wiwakai Treaty Building, A Path to Reconciliation. And how are we using the different tools in negotiations?
What is meant by path to reconciliation? What exactly is reconciliation?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I think it's one of those things where the word probably means different things to different people. You get five people on a podcast and you probably get six different opinions as to what it means. And you know, I've talked to a lot of folks, Mark, who say, you know, we shouldn't call it reconciliation because reconciliation means that we had something in the past that we're reconciling, and we never had a strong relationship in the past with government. So maybe it's not reconciliation, maybe it's something else, maybe we're building something anew. But I think, you know, when we talk about kind of the path to reconciliation, you know, I think whatever that endpoint is, and I think what we're talking about predominantly is a place where your title and your rights are recognized and respected in all of its facets, and that we're carving out a place for the nation to take back its rightful place as self-governing authority over its territory, with economic self-sufficiency, with cultural vibrancy, with language vibrancy, and all of those things. You know, I think because reconciliation means different things to different people, I think the approach we're taking is that, you know, it isn't a straight line. It isn't kind of a, here's the way you get there and nothing else works. I think what we're recognizing is that reconciliation is a living process. It's going to be a living process regardless of whether there's a treaty at the end of the day or not. It's not a straight line. It's got many different approaches. And it's got many different tentacles to it. And I think that's the approach that we've really started to take in the negotiations. I think in treaty, it used to be, you know, even 5 years ago, 10 years ago, certainly when other treaties were signed, where it's like, here's your treaty. You like the treaty, you sign the treaty. And the day after you sign the treaty, you're on your own. And if you don't like the treaty, sue us. You know, it used to be a really kind of stark contrast where you like either you've got the status quo under the Indian Act, or you go into something like a treaty, or you go into a courtroom. And those were very, very difficult choices because none of them necessarily was the panacea or kind of the result that everyone looked for. And there wasn't a way to kind of take a look at reconciliation and say, what are the options or what are the alternatives that we can kind of package together and kind of take the best of what's available and the best of all worlds and use that as the guide for the negotiation. And I think that's really the approach that the treaty team has taken now. The ultimate goal, as Ronnie says, is to put together a package that we can bring forward to the community for consideration. And it's going to have all of those elements. It's going to have the lands, it's going to have self-government, it's going to have the fiscal relationship comprehensive, it's going to have governance across the territory, it's going to have the tax treatment, all of those things that we talk about. That's the end point. But along the way, what are the tools that we can utilize in the reconciliation space that help get us to that place, but also that help bring benefits into the community and that help get your title recognized along that journey? And it's really a combination of those things that are available. And we can talk about some of the examples of that today, but a lot of those things that are available that really, I think what we're talking about when we talk about the path, where we're taking on the best of what's available in order to bring us closer to that goal.
Bram, are you able to explain how treaty would get us there? For example, what would happen if Wewakai did not pursue a treaty and remained under the status quo under the Indian Act? What would happen over time?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I mean, I think one of the things we hear more than anything else is a desire to get out of the Indian Act. The Indian Act is a piece of colonial legislation. The Indian Act essentially allows Canada to ultimately control what governance responsibilities your elected officials have. They're purely delegated authorities under the Indian Act. They're not a true recognition of self-governance. They essentially put you at the whim of the federal government in terms of supporting your programs and services. You're chronically underfunded under the Indian Act. And you're really also at the whim of the federal government in terms of determining rules around status and who actually maintains their ability to be beneficiaries to those programs and services and benefits that may exist under the Indian Act. And we know over time, there's many folks within the Wewakai community who feel very much connected to the community, who are part of the community, but for whoever reason may not be eligible for status. And when you're in a system where it's solely determined by the Indian Act, you're always going to be in a place where you're essentially your pursuit of self-government is stunted. And so, I mean, I think our ultimate goal, as I say, and one we've heard continuously from elders and community members, is to be out of that Indian Act, to be standing on your own two feet and to be reclaiming your rightful place as a self-governing nation outside of the Indian Act. And so from an overall perspective, we think the treaty provides the ultimate, an ability to secure the ultimate goal, which is true self-government outside of the Indian Act, and the place where your governance authorities get constitutional protection, can't be changed, and are elevated to the highest law of the land, and where you have the best opportunity to bring back lands within your territory to your community outside of a reserve base as per the Indian Act. So we think ultimately, you know, the status quo is not what anybody wants. The treaty provides fundamentally the ability to be out of it comprehensively. And then, as I say, along the way, there's some opportunities to be taking back jurisdictions away from the federal and provincial governments and be putting them back in your place. And so you start living that reconciliation space along the journey to treaty. So we think that the treaty process writ large provides a lot of opportunities as you go. And the treaty ultimately is that vehicle for comprehensive self-government.
So what are we relying on to decide, and what are the goals or visions for the Wewakai and our treaty?
Yeah, that's a good question, Mark. So our goal as the treaty team is through this whole process is to try bring a treaty to membership that ticks all the boxes. Does it include the land base? Does it include economic opportunities? Does it return jurisdiction and decision-making in our territory? Not just for now, but for future generations as well.
I think ultimately, Mark, the measure of whether a treaty meets the objectives of the community is going to be up to the membership, obviously. We think that by doing these types of communications, what we're trying to do is bring as much information forward as possible to inform that type of decision. And the reason we're doing a lot more of it now, I mean, I think a lot of reasons, but the reason we're doing a lot more of it now is because there is more of a toolbox that we're using now than what community members may have heard about treaties in the past, or even the treaties that exist today. And, you know, we've talked previously, and maybe there'll be topics about a future podcast about the changes that we've made, for example, in the treaty around periodic renewal. So it used to be that, you know, you sign the treaty on Monday, on Tuesday, the world changes and the government says, well, you're stuck. You signed the treaty on Monday. We've now built in this process around periodic renewal, where at regular increments, we're going to be able to open up the treaty, make sure that it's doing the work that Ronnie just articulated for the membership, for the nation at that point, not membership, citizenry of Wewakai. Is it doing the work that we want it to do? Is it keeping up with changes in case law? Is it keeping up with changes in policy? And if it isn't, we're able to bring those things into the treaty to make sure, as I said at the start, that reconciliation is a living and breathing kind of process, and that the treaty isn't the be all and end all. It's part of that process.
You just mentioned like the periodic review. What's the timeline on that? If you can explain that to members of how often we would be able to open up this treaty.
The treaty provides for it to happen at 10-year increments. So that's the treaty. That's the current model that we're building into the treaty. Now, no treaty has yet been ratified with that model in it, but that's what's received approval in the federal system and the provincial system, and what we think might work. We want there to be enough time to live the treaty to get to the place where that process is really meaningful. And what we've built in is into the treaty, and we can share this language, is common objectives and indicators that we can use in that renewal process to see whether it is doing the work that we want it to do. So is under the treaty, the nation reaching equity and parity with the non-Indigenous neighbors in terms of education and health and quality of life and socioeconomic indicators and all of those things. So we can say it is doing the work. We are maximizing the land base that we've received through treaty settlement lands. We are maximizing our decision-making authority throughout the territory. We are using our jurisdictions to bring in own source revenue into the nation, all those things. And a lot of this you're doing already, but the periodic renewal at those increments gives you the opportunity to really to do a deep dive and make sure that's working, and particularly also the fiscal relationship with the feds. We know that money is going to be coming in on an annual basis from the federal government to support your government. We need to make sure that's sufficient to run your government. We need to make sure it's sufficient to pay the FTEs, the salaries that they require in order to do the work for the nation and not go off and look for work elsewhere. You need to make sure that that's actually working and you've got a fully functioning government. And so this gives you the ability to review that and to make appropriate changes when the time comes.
And we have heard a lot of talk of other nations going into litigation to have their rights and title recognized. You know, some members have asked us, why is this not a route we are taking? Instead, we have chosen to use the toolbox that comes out of these court cases. It does not mean we can't or won't use litigation in the future, but if and when we do, it has to be well thought out and planned.
Yeah, I think that's right. Some may say, why don't you? I think it's a good question. Doesn't mean we won't. And indeed, a lot of the work that we're doing now from a Liquita perspective to try to ensure recognition of Liquita title over your core area, and the work that we're doing in the Campbell River watershed in particular, really relies on kind of that strength of claim information that we've developed over a long period of time that could ground a court case if and when it was deemed appropriate that you aren't getting that recognition through the processes that we're in. But I think, as you say, that type of decision is not one that comes lightly. As we know, litigation is, especially title litigation, is extremely, extremely expensive, extremely time consuming, and the governments fight it tooth and nail, obviously. You also look at what are the results that may yield from a title case. And if you look at some of the case law that's out there, we obviously now have examples through Tilcoteen of the first successful title case, and some of the others that are in development. It's a very, very careful process to determine geographically where that title may rest. And if you look at Tilcoteen, they were successful in obtaining title over a portion of the territory, certainly not all of it. And it does yield questions about what happens to the rest of the territory. And even vis-a-vis those title lands, there's lots of questions about how to implement that title and what does it mean in terms of the relationship with government, in terms of the relationship with third parties. And we think that we're doing a bunch of that work outside of court. We think, based on the relationships that we've developed in the treaty space and including with third parties, we're building this space for title recognition in a negotiated context where we now have language in the treaty about title recognition. It's no longer a cede, release, surrender model. It's no longer a modification model. Your title exists. It's recognized. And this is really an agreement about how the relationship, about the relationship between that title and government and other third parties. And so we think we're doing a lot of that work absent a declaration from the court that you have title. Never say never, but I think that's part of the approach. Take what we've learned from title litigation and try to integrate that into our negotiation to be able to achieve that in a negotiated context as opposed to being in courtroom.
So I actually have two questions. The first, I was hoping you can clarify the cede, release, and surrender aspect of old treaties or treaties that have been signed in the past, because I do know, speaking with other community members, this has obviously been a major discourse for people supporting the treaty. And then my second question, beyond litigation and treaty, what are some other approaches that other nations are carrying out? For example, I hear about reconciliation tables instead of treaty tables.
Yeah, thanks. Two really good questions. I guess on the first one, you know, from a cede, release, surrender perspective, and of course, there's been a transition kind of in this through kind of the older treaties to the modern treaties to the ones we're negotiating. I think the easiest way to cede and release and surrender is basically a fundamental exchange, if you will, of your Aboriginal title for your treaty rights. So in those treaties and in that concept of cede, release, and surrender, you're essentially surrendering your title and you're releasing government from any claims or any liabilities as they relate to your title. So essentially it's like your title is released, is surrendered, and instead you've got this bundle of treaty rights. And that was a model that really was not going to work in a modern context. Nobody had an interest in a cede and release and surrender model in a modern context. It's not consistent with case law. It's not consistent with the fact that title exists and predates European sovereignty or claims of sovereignty. And it certainly doesn't work in a reconciliation space where it's about reconciling title that exists with crown interests. So that was kind of the cede and release and surrender, which, you know, you still hear as like, oh, why would you do treaty? You're surrendering. And I think it's, you know, we need to be really clear that we're not in a cede, release, surrender model. The next thing that happened is we moved from a cede, release, surrender model to what we call a modification model, where your title isn't released, it isn't ceded, it isn't surrendered, but you're agreeing to kind of modify or change that title to your treaty rights. And so a softer approach, certainly, to the cede and release and surrender. I still think there's some questions about kind of modification and what fundamentally the difference is between cede, release, surrender and modification. But that was part of the transition. And then now we're at this place where we're in more of a kind of a recognition model, where the language actually talks about a recognition that title exists. Now, how do we all get along based on that recognition. And you're still agreeing to assert those rights and assert that title in a manner that fundamentally gets agreed upon by the parties, but your underlying title exists. It doesn't change. It isn't ceded. It isn't released. It isn't surrendered. So I think that's a really important kind of transition. On your second point, yes. And I think this goes back to the kind of this path to reconciliation, and there isn't necessarily a one size fits all, and there wasn't necessarily any clear lines. Both the provincial and federal governments have made available processes outside of the treaty process where certain aspects of the negotiation that you'd find in treaty are being dealt with kind of in a mostly bilateral way and on a smaller scale. So for example, you mentioned reconciliation negotiations. There is a process that the federal government has launched, recognition of Indigenous rights and reconciliation table, where the nations can sit down with Canada and suss out kind of areas within federal jurisdiction where there may be a place to have a negotiation around an agreement that's not a treaty agreement, that's not constitutionally protected, but that is grounded in reconciliation. So some of those things might be around certain self-government authorities that a nation might want to negotiate, fiscal arrangements that a nation might want to negotiate. And an example I think that's live for us is fisheries. So for example, one of the decisions that we've made, and this is part of this concept of using the tools that are available, we've opened up a separate reconciliation table with the federal government on fisheries through the Atlagay member nations. So the Atlagay member nations, the five nations, have come together and have opened a fisheries table that's outside of treaty, that's within the reconciliation space, and that offers an opportunity to pursue a significant mandate around fisheries in terms of access to resources and also governance. But we're doing that while we're negotiating the treaty. There is a space for these reconciliation tables with Canada. They're discreet. I think what nations are finding is that maybe it's taking Canada as long to get the mandates to do those as it is in treaty. So one of the benefits of doing them may not be as beneficial. Canada is really struggling to get the mandates to move those tables forward. But that is some things that nations are pursuing. And same with the province. Some nations are moving into bilateral negotiations with the province where they're taking discrete areas, mostly around lands and resources, and trying to work with the province around incremental benefits flowing and relationship development in areas of provincial jurisdiction. We're also doing that in the context of treaty negotiations. We have ongoing negotiations with the province on collaborative decision making within the Campbell River watershed. I talked about that earlier. We're doing a number of things with the province, like our incremental treaty agreement, that could otherwise be done within that reconciliation space. We're just doing it along the journey to treaty. So we still have that treaty, but we're chunking it up and taking incremental benefits as we go. So those are a couple examples, that some nations are pursuing more discrete type negotiations with the province and the federal government. Some are choosing variations of the status quo, staying under the Indian Act, maybe doing a land code, which you've done, maybe doing other things to take back parts of jurisdiction from Canada from under the Indian Act. But treaty still provides that fundamental ability to remove the Indian Act altogether. So hope that's helpful in terms of some of the things other nations are doing.
Definitely, thank you.
Yeah, so I've been hearing what others have been saying about the treaty and up and coming treaty. And there's a lot of fear about them losing what we have now, the certain rights and everything we have now. And you guys have cleared up quite a bit of that, but I want to know, is there any risk or downside to doing a treaty?
I don't think so. Before debt was the big thing with the treaty, and we no longer have a treaty debt that's been wiped off the books. In my opinion, that was the biggest risk was the debt. I think we can only gain, really. Like, treaty is a good way to have our rights and title recognized, also to regain the jurisdiction within our territory over things that are important to us. And it is the only way for us to get out from the Indian Act. I think we should all be excited about that. We are only people in Canada who are legislated like this from birth to death. It's time for us to end that kind of oppression for us and for our children and grandchildren. None of the other processes like court or reconciliation tables provide the same opportunity. And just working under the Indian Act and downloading authorities the government chooses to give us, I don't think is good enough.
You know, Mark, certainly there's always going to be concerns. And again, this is part of why we're doing this. So we have open dialogue and can address things. And ultimately, it's going to be a membership citizenship decision. I always think there's like the big three, that the detriments to treaty ratification, like, you know, there may be other things, but there are certainly three things that we felt like we needed to fundamentally change in negotiations. We needed to get rid of debt. And we needed to get rid of loans, which we've successfully done, as Roddy said. We needed to get rid of the seed release surrender nonsense and the modification, which we've just talked about. We've now moved to a recognition model. The third thing I feel like we need to get rid of is the loss of the tax exemption. And obviously that was the first podcast on the Section 87 exemption. But Mark, if you talk about losing things that you have, and we talk about this a lot, there's no interest in moving backwards on anything. And the exemption is important. And we're fighting to maintain that exemption because we know that Wewakai citizens are going to believe that that's important and believe that they shouldn't lose the exemption. And folks can listen to the first podcast and talk about where we talk about our efforts to on that front. But I think those are the big three. I really believe that if we can knock down those big three, and we already talked about periodic renewal, I think that's another one, then all of a sudden some of that fear factor goes away. You know, I think there's lots of questions about loss of programs and services. What's going to happen with my eyeglass prescriptions? What's going to happen with dental? What's going to happen with all those things? And a perception that some of those things are going to vanish. And in the second podcast, we talked about the fiscal relationship that we're developing with Canada and made it very, very clear that all of the fiscal relationships are about moving forward, filling gaps in currently underfunded programs and services, but also building up this core governance where your government is funded way beyond what it currently gets for band support funding to actually run a government. And so it's a really good test, Mark, because every step of the way we're like, is this better than what we currently have? If yes, that's great. If not, how do we fix it? Because there's no intent to move backwards. So, you know, I know there are concerns. I think a lot of the concerns are around the finality of it. And that, you know, that fear around, you know, we're walking into the unknown, and it is the unknown. And that's part of why we're doing it the way we're doing, which is a long transition period, picking up benefits as we go, and then really presenting the best package as that we can to citizens to, you know, to agree with or not. And I think, you know, I keep using the term citizens because it's also really important to recognize that under the treaty, you get to determine who your citizens are. You know, people who have status maintain their status. There's no impact on status. And that's also fear some people have, that they'll lose their status. You don't lose your status by going into treaty. You maintain your status, but what the treaty allows you to do is welcome people into the Wewakai community that may not have status, but that are part of your community and that you want them to be part of your community, and you determine who your citizens are. And there's really no other process that allows you to do that, right? So hopefully a lot of this communication can address some of those concerns. At the end of the day, people are going to look at it and say, it's good enough, it's not. We can't really control that, but we can control how much information we're getting out there.
There's been a lot of time dedicated to this whole negotiation process. What happens if you feel like you prepared a good package, but the community turns it down? Like that is a possibility. Would you go back negotiating again, or is that the end of it? Or?
It's definitely a possibility. It's happened before. You know, I think what we don't, I mean, ultimately it's a possibility, and ultimately it's the choice of those who enroll in the treaty to vote it down if they choose to. You know, I think our role in presenting the best package we can is twofold. We don't want to stop negotiating until we think we've done the best we possibly can, number one, so the community can actually look at the best package. But number two, I don't think we want to go to a vote until while any stone is left unturned. We are going to have a very comprehensive communication strategy over a long period of time to talk to everyone about treaty. It's going to be a document like this, right? You know, and no one's necessarily, some people might, not everyone, going to read every word of it, but people have to fundamentally understand what they're voting on. And, you know, we think there's a lot of myths around treaty that we'd like to fix. There's a lot of legitimate concerns with treaty that we'd like to answer. So I think, Mark, what we can do, we can't control whether it's going to be yes or no, but again, we can control the timing to make sure that we're not going, you're not going to a vote until you're convinced that every single person who's voting has a really good understanding of what they're voting on. And I think that's what we want to do. If at the end of the day, there's a no vote, you know, your leadership's going to have to reassess what it's, what it chooses to do. I don't think we can answer that question now. But I think we want to encourage people to attend sessions, to listen to podcasts, to do the lunch and learns that we're doing, just to get as much information as possible. So we're really starting that process. So it comes from a place of full education when it comes time to eventually vote.
Yeah, we've had a lot of discussion on building the Wiwakai Treaty. So I have a question for Sydney and Mark. Is there anything you learned today that may have changed your mind about the treaty? Or do you have any questions you may want to ask us?
Yes, sure. I'll definitely go first here. Yeah, so I didn't know about the opportunity to take reviews periodically on the 10-year basis. So that is a really an amazing component that obviously wasn't there before. So thank you for sharing that, as well as the possibility that there's some ability to retain this the status exemption. I know that that's been a large component for people or a concern as to why they might not vote for a treaty. I don't have any questions right now, but thank you for sharing. I definitely feel like I learned a lot.
As for me, I also didn't know about that 10-year review. Long ago, the chief and council of the day, going back some probably 50 years, was when Cape Mudge, Wiwakai people were going to become the first Indian municipality in Canada. And there was a lot of work done on it. And it was to go before the membership for a vote. And because it was such a big change, they upped it instead of 50% plus one, they upped it to 75%. And the darn thing failed, eh? But in that negotiations, they had it that at any time, right, we could opt out of that municipality and go back into the Indian Act. And it was a beauty thing, right? Like, if you didn't like it, you could just fall back into the other thing. And that's why I like about this 10-year review is that I'm hoping that's something similar to that. You know, and the other thing is, I don't know, like, I've always wanted to see where this treaty would take us. Like I'm excited to see what the feds have to offer, especially in lieu of all the court cases they've lost to date. You know, like, holy cow. Like, we as a people were brought up knowing, you know, not believing, but knowing this is our land. This is our land, right? We are the stewards of this property. So, yeah. That's all.
All right. Thanks for that, Mark. And thanks, Sydney, as well for the opinion that you gained today. That's good to hear that we've got some information out that people may not know. You know, we're trying to get this stuff out as much as possible. So it's great having new people on the podcast today. Also appreciate the discussion that we had today. I think we've come a long way from the early days of treaty where Canada and BC really had limited mandates. Now with title recognition and periodic renewals, the implementation of UNDRIP, and also the ways to implement shared decision-making and jurisdictions throughout our territory. I think we need to push on and to have our needs met. I also think we owe our past generations who have told us to fight for our rights and to our children and grandchildren who want to be set up for success. So, Bram, do you have any final comments?
I think I just want to extend again appreciation to Sydney and Mark for doing this. It's I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you guys and answer any questions. And hopefully this is just the start of the dialogue, and we can encourage other folks to take part as well. So I just want to appreciate your interest. And it's huge for us, right? Like being out and negotiating, it's really important that we're channeling the vision of the community, right? We want to be testing this with you guys and making sure we're on the right track. So super helpful for me and encouraging. So wanted to thank you for that, and thank you, Ronnie, for the leadership that you and the board are demonstrating towards this process and all of the pieces that we're trying to put together as we talked about today.
All right, thanks, Bram. Mark, do you have any closing comments you'd like to make?
Yeah, I've learned a lot today with the short time we've had and what's been said. I'm really happy in the direction we're going. I especially like that 10-year review thing, and of course, nobody will vote for treaty if that tax thing is taken off the table. Like you can be taxed other places, but not on your own property. You know, like we never had to pay taxes before the war and what have you, but that's a whole nother thing. But I would encourage everyone, grandparents, parents, to bring their grandchildren to these treaty talks and get involved and get to know what's going on. So that when the day comes and you're going to vote yes or no in that ballot box, you'll have a very good understanding on what's really going on, rather than just walk in there, oh, so-and-so said I shouldn't vote for this, so I better not vote for it. And, I've been watching this treaty thing for, I don't know what it's been, 20 or 30 years now, and it's come a long ways. I'm proud of where we're at right now. We've come a long ways. Anyhow, thanks, guys.
All right, thanks for that, Mark. Sydney, do you have anything you'd like to close out with?
Yeah, for sure. I actually have a bit of a differing opinion than Mark on the status exemption portion. I personally, I would see the benefit in paying tax to my own nation. That is how it'd work. We wouldn't be, the taxes that we pay would be going back to our own government. It wouldn't be going to the Canadian government. So I see the benefit in providing revenue for services and schools and infrastructure. That wouldn't be a be all end all for myself. I think for me, it's always been the component of coming out from under the Indian Act, which is something that's been covered a few times here. I mean, even the language, the Indian Act, it's not appropriate. It's not where we should be any longer. And that's why I've always been a proponent of treaty. So again, thank you for inviting me to be part of this. And I look forward to seeing how this develops in the future.
Thanks for those comments there, Sydney. Also, I'd just like to thank you all for listening to the podcast again. We hope you enjoyed it. So if you have not seen our other podcasts, they are available on our website and Spotify. Also remember, there are all kinds of ways for you to learn about treaty. We have our regular newsletters that we are posting on the website. You can also visit our website, watch our social media posts, attend our monthly Zoom lunch and learns, where you can meet directly with all of our team. And eventually we'll host the open house as soon as this COVID situation calms down. Because we're moving into the fourth wave of COVID here again, we're putting these in-person meetings on hold, hopefully not for too long, but we're hoping that the spring might be the safer time. And lastly, the podcast, this is our third one, and we hope that you are finding the information useful and hope they're informative. So if anyone has any other suggestions for us on methods of communication, we'd love to hear from you, either by email at info@lkts.ca or call the office at 250-287-9000. 9460. Once again, we hope you found today's podcast informative as we continue to keep the Wiwakai members informed about our treaty negotiations. And thank you for listening.